The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What fascinates me in all of this, in this most unusual confirmation process, is I'm beginning to wonder whether Gina Haspel even wanted to be nominated as director of the CIA. We've already discussed how she never could have imagined or expected that she would be in this position. And we know that last Friday, as the tensions grew within the White House over her chances of being confirmed, and some White House officials began to get very nervous about those chances, that Gina Haspel took the extraordinary step of offering to withdraw her nomination, basically saying, I'm out, enough. And we understand that she did that because she did not want this public drama to grow even bigger and potentially damage the CIA and damage her own reputation.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 8th, 2018. Gina Haspel goes before the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow for confirmation as the CIA's director. It's gonna be hairy. Haspel, the CIA's current deputy director, was deeply involved in the CIA's coercive interrogation program in the years that followed 9/11. She also has an extremely distinguished career as a case officer in a wide variety of areas. Shane Harris of The Washington Post recently produced a lengthy and detailed profile of Haspel. He joined me this morning to discuss the nomination, the cases for and against her, and what we can expect when she faces the committee tomorrow. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 308, Shane Harris on Gina Haspel.
So, Shane, who is Gina Haspel?
Well, Gina Haspel is a 61-year-old career clandestine officer in the CIA. She has been in the agency for 33 years. She joined in January of 1985. And for nearly every one of those 33 years, she has been in positions that are undercover. She is currently the deputy director of the CIA, which is the number two, and that is the only publicly acknowledged position in the CIA she has held up until about 2 weeks ago, when the CIA began declassifying some of the positions that she had held. But to give you kind of a biographical sketch of her, she joins in 1985 as a trainee in what's then, well, what is now too known as the Directorate of Operations. So this is the part of the agency that trains its officers to go to foreign countries and to recruit people to spy on their governments there and become spies for the United States. So to run agents, if you like. She serves in the beginning of her career in Ethiopia in the late 1980s, sort of in this twilight of the Cold War period, Ethiopia then being a recipient of tremendous amounts of Soviet aid. So she's running agents and operatives in the country, really as part of the CIA's Cold War mission against the Soviets. She studies languages. She studies Turkish and Russian. From Ethiopia, she goes on to serve in Ankara. She eventually goes on to be a chief of station in Baku, Azerbaijan in the late 1990s, which at the time would have been considered a rough posting. And as the CIA has told it, actually, in her official biography, was something that raised the eyebrows of men that she worked with who thought, why in the world would they send a woman to a place like that? So there's definitely an element in her career of serving in places where maybe women were not likely to go, but potentially could go and have great success. And she appears to have done that. In Azerbaijan, she's involved actually in an operation to capture two terrorist suspects linked to the African embassy bombings in 1998. And it leads to a capturing of an Al-Qaeda computer that at the time is seen as something of the, as it was called, the Rosetta Stone of Al-Qaeda. It has all kinds of information on the group. Gina Haspel decides that this counterterrorism mission is very interesting to her. So she puts in a transfer, comes back to the counterterrorism center at CIA because she wants to focus on that area. And her first day on the job is September 11th, 2001. And that begins her career that is now transitioned out of the Cold War period and much more into the early stages of the CIA's fight against Al-Qaeda. As one former operations officer who knew her and worked with her told me, she was present at the creation of what we think of as the post-9/11 CIA. And of course, that leads her into her involvement in the interrogation program, which I'm sure we'll talk more about. But she, post that, has a succession of really important senior management jobs in the CIA. She's the chief of staff to the Directorate of Operations. She becomes the number two of the directorate, goes on to be chief of station in London twice, and then becomes the deputy director. So she has this career that really straddles the two eras of the CIA that have been defining, I would say, in the past several decades, this twilight of the Cold War and the dawn of the era of the war against terrorism.
So how unusual is it for a president to nominate somebody whose career history is really hard to discuss or debate because it's all classified?
It is very unusual. I'm confident that Gina Haspel, though I did not interview her, and coincidentally, I once met her very briefly, although didn't know who she was at the time, but I'm confident that Gina Haspel never imagined that she would be nominated as director of the CIA because people like her, which is to say career clandestine officers, don't usually get nominated to run the CIA. It has been many, many years, decades, I think, since a career officer came up through the ranks without ever leaving the CIA and then became the director. It is obviously extraordinary that she's the first woman to be nominated for the post. But I would argue just as extraordinary, maybe not as extraordinary, but also extraordinary that someone who truly did spend her life in the shadows and whose resume is only being declassified in sometimes in broad strokes to be nominated for this position. I mean, everything that I told you about where she served, the CIA did not disclose that. They would only disclose titles and regions. So this is very unusual. And of course, the most contentious and controversial period of her career. While there's a lot that is known about that, there are still elements of that period, the interrogation program, that remain classified, and that is becoming a major obstacle on her path to confirmation.
So we have, let's, out of her career, distill the case for her. She has the enthusiastic support of senior formers at CIA of both parties. She seems to be well liked and well respected within the agency. Make, if you will, the affirmative case for Gina Haspel. What's the best argument that we can expect to hear in the Senate's consideration of her over the next few days?
Well, there are really two prongs to the argument, one of which is the one you'll hear put forward in coming days, and another one that people will say privately. So the public argument for her is very much as you just said. She has so much experience in the heart and soul aspects of the mission of the CIA, which is to gather information from humans, to get people to spy on their countries, to get people to be informants on organizations. She has spent her life doing that. Many people emphasize that she was highly skilled in tradecraft, which is sort of the know-how of the tricks and tools and techniques that spies in the field use. She was very steeped in that. She is very good, people say, at judging when someone is likely to be a credible source versus not, what the risks of a certain source might be. And she's seen the time in the agency in these two kind of defining areas, the Cold War and the War on Terror. And I think lastly, you would say that she's an expert on Russia. This is actually, she's worked in a number of senior positions in Russian operations, which is to say either, you know, trying to gather information about Russia or counter Russian spying. And that would be very attractive at a time when Russian intelligence operations against the U.S. are paying off pretty enormous dividends. The private argument for her would be, and is made privately, that she could be a bulwark against Donald Trump. This is someone who the intelligence community has great reservations about. I think probably that's an understatement. We've talked a lot about that before. They see Haspel as one of them and somebody who can potentially stand up to the president, who has so maligned intelligence officials, who's accused them of trying to delegitimize his election. And there is a sense, I think, that Gina Haspel is kind of the right person to defend the CIA's interests. And then, frankly, there's also a sense of, if not Gina Haspel, could the administration nominate somebody who is hostile to the agency or is a much less desirable alternative? So I think they're kind of, you know, high-fiving at Langley that they've got one of their own in this position and want her confirmed because the alternative could be, from their view, really upsetting and quite negative.
The private argument isn't all that private. I mean, General Hayden, who of course ran the CIA, has been out very much in public, including on Sunday talk shows, saying he wants her confirmed because she's somebody he's confident will speak truth to power to President Trump. And he's done that in the context of promoting a book that is all about conducting intelligence in what he calls an age of lies. So I'm kind of interested in how much more intense that argument is in the private setting than it is in the public setting.
Yeah, and you're quite right to point that out. And I think John Brennan, the former CIA director, also has been on record in that way. And people like to use the phrase speak truth to power because it's sort of, you know, it's noble sounding. And it kind of it does a lot of work for you when you're using the phrase. What I'm talking about is people privately, more at the career level, who believe that the president is a threat to the CIA and think he is a conspiracy theorist and are, frankly, very scared about what his leadership represents and believe that Gina Haspel is a calming force in that, who will defend the agency's interests. And there is an element, too, of there have been other names floated to become director who people feel would not at all be defending their interests and people at CIA don't trust. I mean, there's a real
fear of Tom Cotton.
There's a real fear of Tom Cotton. You said it. I think there are people who I've talked to over the past year who feel that this is a disaster for the intelligence community to have a commander in chief who lies repeatedly publicly, who has, the only use for facts seems to be to manipulate facts towards his argument. That's certainly the way people I've talked to in the CIA see it. And they breathed a sigh of relief when Mike Pompeo turned out to be actually a fairly effective leader and someone who had their back, because many of them saw him as a ruthless partisan who was best known for his theories and the Benghazi attacks. His mother's fudge. Well, that's close to your heart, Ben. But, you know, and Gina Haspel was the deputy director when Pompeo was the director. And that provided, I think, a buffering function for the agency. So what you hear from people privately, I mean, it is in essence what Mike Hayden and John Brennan are saying. It's just that I think that people privately, you know, are much more gleeful over Gina Haspel's nomination and tend to more vocally freak out when talking about the administration.
So is it fair to say that the support for her is all but uniform across the agency, that this is somebody who, you know, however rough a confirmation hearing she has on Wednesday, that reflects public anxieties about the interrogation program, not anything internal within the CIA about the possibility of her leadership.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I could not find career people in the CIA and out of the CIA to say a really unkind word about her, which is not to say that everyone thinks she walks on water, but there's nearly uniform support for this nominee within the ranks.
Okay, so that's side one of the discussion. Let's talk about the other side of the discussion. What is the best case against Gina Haspel? How involved in this program was she? What was the nature of her involvement? And to what extent are people arguing that that is preclusive of service in this capacity?
Well, the basic argument against her is that she was involved on a, I think it's fair to say, a specific and intimate level with the interrogation program. And people who don't support her nomination say that that is the original sin, that that is immediately disqualifying, given the lessons learned from that period, but also in the minds of her critics, the scandalous nature of what the CIA did, and many people's view the illegal nature of what the CIA did, although that's perhaps a separate debate. And people who say, look, that someone who managed one of the detention facilities while an individual was waterboarded, that someone who served in a senior position in counterterrorism while these programs were running, that someone who certainly was, even before she was read in perhaps on what the interrogation techniques were, who certainly knew that the CIA was getting much of the information it had in early days after 9/11 from the interrogations of human beings, that she's completely tied to the program. And the question of whether, like, well, how deep in it was she, and did she run it versus just follow orders in it? And when she's the, was she the architect of it? No, not really, but she was the architect of some other counterterrorism programs. For the people who, you know, get at the essence of why she's not qualified for the job, I think the degrees of her involvement are less important. Nobody is arguing that she wasn't a significant player in the program, even if she wasn't the one calling the shots. And that is just disqualifying. I will say, though, and I mean, not to jump ahead on this, but what's interesting about that, though, is if you compare her then to John Brennan, who also—
That was going to be my next question.
Okay, so let's go there. You know, John Brennan had a more senior position than Gina Haspel in the CIA at the time the interrogation program was running. He was an aide, an advisor to the director of the CIA at the time, George Tenet. Certainly
he was around
knew.
The leadership table when big decisions were made.
When big decisions were made. And we'll recall that when John Brennan was first floated as the nominee for CIA director in 2009, the Obama administration ultimately withdrew him because they were worried he couldn't get confirmed given his history and connection to the agency and to this program. Now, fast forward 4 years after that, he'd been in the White House as an advisor to Obama. In 2013, he's nominated and confirmed. So a number of people I've talked to have raised the question and said, okay, if the Senate can confirm John Brennan for director, why can't they confirm Gina Haspel? Is it because it's matters of degrees, or is there something else going on here?
So let's talk about three possible differences here, because I think they're independently interesting. So one is that she was a field person. She was actually running a detention site, and she actually was involved in the destruction of tapes.
Right.
Whereas he was leadership level and therefore arguably more responsible in some sense, but less operationally hands-on on the activities that people most object to. What do you think? Which direction does that cut?
If I'm just looking at that objectively, I think that then what you're saying is, okay, so punish the platoon sergeant, but don't punish the general. I mean, I'm probably mixing up the metaphors here. But Gina Haspel, what many people have told me was, You know, she was following orders. She was not in a position within the CIA hierarchy to stop this program or do something about it. That's not the way things work. Okay, well, John Brennan arguably was in a position to do that. So if we're saying that Gina Haspel is just the person following orders, we can't expect her to try to derail the program or blow the whistle, but we've confirmed the guy who arguably could have. It seems to me if you're just objectively weighing that, then she gets confirmed because I think she passes that test if that's the equation.
Okay, second factor that I think may explain the difference. John Brennan has publicly and frequently said that he was an opponent internally of the program at the time. Now, this is complicated by the fact that I am not aware of many of his colleagues from that time who back him on that. And in fact, some, you know, there, I have heard some grumbling over the years. You know, Brennan says he was an opponent of the program. I sat with him at a table for, you know, for every one of those meetings, never heard any opposition from him. But he has publicly described himself as having been opposed to it. She has not. How much do you think that's inflecting the basic forgiveness of Brennan?
I actually think what you're putting your finger on is something that's much more important to Haspel. That is the key thing that she's going to have to contend with on Wednesday. The reason that she has not publicly spoken out about this program one way or the other is because she literally has not publicly spoken many times.
You know, we don't even know what her voice sounds like.
And we actually do, believe it or not. She was captured on tape at the OSS Society Gala last year.
But she had those tapes destroyed.
She had them destroyed. Right. I was in the room for that, and I about spilled my drink when I saw that that she was on the stage. But what you're going to see, I think, on Wednesday is her having to answer a variant of precisely the question that you just asked, which is basically, where do you stand on this program? Did you think that it worked? Should we do it again? Did you ever raise any concerns internally? I've been told by U.S. officials who have seen documents on the program that haven't been made public that she is something of an enthusiastic supporter of that program at the time that it's happening. So she's going to have to answer that question. And while I agree with you, there's not a lot in the historical record to back up John Brennan as a vocal opponent of interrogations. He nevertheless is one now. And Gina Haspel is going to be asked, where do you stand?
So the third factor, which to me is the one that's most salient, honestly, is the president who's nominating. I look at having somebody who was involved in the program and says he didn't support it at the time and really doesn't support it now, nominated by somebody who has ended the program and who considers it a torture program and who's a vocal opponent of it, is a very different matter from having somebody who was involved in the program at an operational level, nominated by somebody whose promises to bring back waterboarding and do way more and, you know, shows no moral reservation about it whatsoever. And so how much of this is really about the difference between Donald Trump and Barack Obama?
I think for many senators, that may be the fundamental deciding factor. You haven't seen sufficient senators come out and say that they're going to vote for her to make her nomination or confirmation a done deal at this point. But I think there are probably a number of Democrats who are waiting to make sure that she doesn't completely blow it at the hearing on Wednesday and disqualify herself, who will eventually vote for her. Precisely because of that distinction that you just articulated, because Donald Trump has said torture works. He said he wants to bring it back. Gina Haspel will be asked for her commitment that she would not do that. And I think that they will ultimately decide that though her hands are certainly dirty when it comes from their perspective to with torture, they want somebody in there who has publicly expressed that she would stand up to the president. And they see her as a buffer. I think that's kind of her ace in the hole at this point.
One of the oddities of this nomination is the bizarre public campaign that the CIA has gone on her behalf. And I am unaware not merely of the CIA ever having, you know, done this before, but of really any agency lobbying for its nominee or sort of going on a public campaign for the confirmation of somebody nominated to head it. How do you evaluate the CIA's public posture here?
It is unique for all the reasons that you just pointed out. What I see in the agency's decision to lobby aggressively for Gina Haspel, I see two things. And the biggest thing is a genuine, I think, affection and for and belief in the nominee. This is somebody who, as we said before, I mean, the CIA rank and file, and that's who comprises the Office of Public Affairs and Legislative Affairs that's doing this, believe that she's a highly qualified candidate and they want to see her win. But more to the point, they also understand all of her vulnerabilities and completely are, you know, are trying to reckon with them. And know that they have to, or I think they believe they have to, mount an effort to get her confirmed, because she simply can't be confirmed, or they don't think that she can just be confirmed like the way everyone else is, absent that kind of an intervention. So you're seeing both the results of a deep affection and loyalty for Gina Haspel, as well as a calculation that she needs the help. And what fascinates me in all of this, in this most unusual confirmation process, is I'm beginning to wonder whether Gina Haspel even wanted to be nominated as director of the CIA. We've already discussed how she never could have imagined or expected that she would be in this position. And we know that last Friday, as the tensions grew within the White House over her chances of being confirmed, and some White House officials began to get very nervous about those chances, that Gina Haspel took the extraordinary step of offering to withdraw her nomination, basically saying, I'm out, enough. And we understand that she did that because she did not want this public drama to grow even bigger and potentially damage the CIA and damage her own reputation. We're told that she actually said in private meetings with White House officials, I do not want to be the next Ronnie Jackson. Referring to the VA secretary nominee who had to pull his own nomination. There is a real sense, and I don't think it's phony, of institutional loyalty on her part to the agency. And in her approach to this process and what I've been able to glean from it, I think it's taken a huge toll on her. She is not a political actor. She's not used to this kind of scrutiny and spotlight, having to interact with senators from the point of view of someone who is seeking their vote. And it just makes me wonder. I mean, I think that she's probably proud to do it, but I wonder if secretly she thinks it would have been much easier had this not happened. The strain has been obviously quite extraordinary on her. And I think you see that in the agency too. I mean, it's they're taking a lot of hits themselves because they have been out there lobbying for her. It's been, by their critics, it's being called an influence and propaganda campaign. That's not something that sits well with them either.
Let's talk about her options tomorrow. It seems to me there's, broadly speaking, three broad strains of thought within CIA about how to think about the RDI program in retrospect. One is the sort of George Tenet, Jose Rodriguez, to a lesser extent, John Rizzo version, which is no apologies, we did what we needed to do. You know, in Rizzo's case, it's tempered by we should have had more congressional buy-in, more public. But, you know, we did what we needed to do. It was effective, and people, you know, should just accept that we did our jobs. The second version is the Brennan version. It was a mistake. People were acted in good faith, but we shouldn't have done it. And we certainly would never do anything like it again. The third version is it may have been necessary at the time that we did it, or it was necessary at the time that we did it. it is not necessary to do something like that now or at any time in the foreseeable future. And therefore, you know, what was appropriate in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 would be wildly inappropriate at any in any circumstance that we could imagine coming up. We're just a much more mature counterterrorism operation now, and we don't need to do that sort of thing. And the institutional damage to the agency is high when you do it. Which of those, or if not those, some other course, do you expect her to tack when she testifies tomorrow? It seems to me she can't do the no apologies, no regrets version if she expects to get confirmed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she could, but then she won't be the CIA director. I think she's going to tack more towards number three. What I like about that path that you've laid out is it articulates something that a number of current and former officials have argued to me, which is that we don't need to do interrogations anymore because we're far more sophisticated in our understanding of how to do counterterrorism operations and analysis than we were on September 11th, 2001. And there, I think that she is, I'm hesitant to say how I think she's going to characterize that period because we just really don't know. And she was so closely involved in it that she may surprise us and have a whole other way of thinking about it. But broadly speaking, I do think that she's going to make the argument that there were things that we did then, put aside whether we should or shouldn't have done them, that we just don't need to do now. Because we're so much better at collecting information and intelligence. I also think that kind of with that, or maybe closely alongside that, what she's going to argue is that while the CIA will always have a counterterrorism function, we're past the point now where that is the primary mission of the agency, which it was for many years after 9/11. It was sort of counterterrorism, then everything else that falls underneath it. And what she's going to say is we're really good at that. The threat is still there. It's obviously not as intense maybe as it was on 9/10. It's more diffuse, but we're really good at it. But we've also got to get back to dealing with traditional nation state adversaries, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. And I think she's going to look for lots of opportunity to talk about Iran and North Korea specifically, and maybe North Korea the most, because she's actually been involved in that, and to sound the alarm on Russia. I think that she's going to find a receptive audience in senators being a Russia hand as she is, saying that this is a target that we cannot ignore. I would imagine she will push that experience of her own much more to the front and try and make the argument essentially like, I get it, this very dark chapter after 9/11 is something we all have a lot of reservations about, and we're always going to have to kind of just live with this. But you know, this Russia thing is happening, and I'm really good at this and really smart, and you need to put me at the front of the agency leading against that threat, because that is the one that is staring us in the face.
And do you, like, leaving aside the turn back to nation states component of it, just on the we don't need to do this anymore because we've gotten really good at this, we're really sophisticated now, do you buy that argument that they're you know, leave aside whether there was a role for the RDI program post 9/11. One of the things that it reflects was how behind the curve we were then. We have no inside information about Al-Qaeda's thinking. We start capturing senior leadership. There is an exigency to it that drives the program. And right now, we're in pretty good control in the counterterrorism arena. So you just don't have the urgent need to sort of get chalk on your cleats in the way that you did then. Is that a compelling argument to you?
It is, but you asked me if I buy it. I'm not sure I buy it. And I think that one of the reasons that I hesitate is because I wonder if the threat is more manageable now because the CIA has devoted so many resources to finding terrorists and killing them. and that what you've had is a bit more of a kind of a blunt force approach, although through the use of very precise weapons like drones and missiles and these kinds of things, that has sort of dismantled these organizations by destroying them. And if at the same time, the information on who these people were and who you should be hitting with drone strikes had to come from somewhere. And that didn't all come from interrogations. It obviously came from other sources. But I guess I hesitate to say that if we've seen a kind of reduction in the threat of Al-Qaeda, let's say, you know, big Al-Qaeda, it must be because the CIA got really good at attacking big Al-Qaeda, and there must be other ways than interrogation because they're not doing interrogations anymore. I mean, we could also look at, you know, the rise of ISIS and, you know, the way that that seemed to take a lot of people in the Obama administration by surprise and ask questions about, well, was the intelligence good enough for that? I know CIA is extremely defensive and says that they were warning about this. But, you know, I guess the answer is I don't really know. I mean, I think as a practical, political and legal matter, interrogations like this are just off the table. So I suppose you could also speculate that given that they couldn't interrogate people anymore the way they were in 2002 and after, the CIA had to find other ways to get inside Al-Qaeda and other things to do. I will tell you that in having private conversations with people who were involved in that program, there are still people who genuinely, deeply believe it worked and was the best source of information that they had. This is not something they like to talk about publicly.
Many
the sensitivities
people believe
around it. Many people believe this, and I suspect Gina Haspel believes it. I don't know that she'll say it, although she might try to be forced to. So that argument of we've gotten really good, we don't need to do these things, the yeah, but to that, and it's not something that people like to talk about publicly, is this was a major component in their opinion, and they believe that it was a extremely productive one.
Right. I mean, one of the great unresolved questions, you know, you have on the one hand the SSCI majority report at however many thousands of pages arguing that there was not a single piece of intelligence netted from this program that wasn't also available by other means. And on the other hand, you have the fervent conviction of many of the people who were involved in the program and supervised the program that it saved an enormous number of American lives. And there is a never the twain shall meet quality to that debate that I think it's going to require a lot of years and a lot of declassification and a lot of historians without our current passions to begin to resolve that debate in a rigorous fashion. One other question about Gina Haspel. She appears to be something of a Russia hawk in the context of a presidency that is, shall we say, ambivalent on the subject of Russia and Vladimir Putin. What is your read on the idea of having going from director who is, you know, a real Trump loyalist in Mike Pompeo to somebody who's a CIA institutionalist who is, you know, a real skeptic on the idea of a reset or a warm relationship with Russia?
Well, I think we've actually gotten a little bit of a preview of how this is likely to work following the Russian use of the nerve agent outside London recently. So what we now know, and we've reported a bit of this in the Post and others have reported on it too, is that Gina Haspel, who by the way is a lifelong Anglophile and served for 6 years in London and has a lot of affection for the United Kingdom, led the CIA's response to that attack and worked to coordinate expulsions of Russian diplomats, both from the United States and to get allies on board to expel more from their own countries. And what that did was to bring her into the room with President Trump to have to make the argument for doing that. And you use the word ambivalence, and I think that's the right way to look at the administration's approach to Russia. But let's remember what happened after that attack. The United States did expel 60 Russian spies, being believed to be spies, from the United States in closed facilities. That was a very strong response. And I think there's an argument to make that Gina Haspel being in the room and being one of the people advocating for that, and by the way, she also advocated for more, the fact that she and others got President Trump to sign off on that. My understanding is that at the time that it was happening, he was even to some extent kind of happy to be doing it because it made him look tough. But I think what that tells you is that the possible next CIA director already has a pretty good feel for how this president thinks and knows how to persuade him towards her arguments and the arguments of people who want to go harder on Russia. This is not to say that she's pulling his strings or could simply get him to do whatever the CIA and others want on Russia. But I think that in that incident, you got your first real sense for how her very kind of clear-eyed, historically informed view of Russia as a threat is going to line up with the way that the president sees things.
What are you looking for tomorrow?
I think it's going to be, number one, it's just going to be interesting to, hear this person talk for more than 30 seconds, giving a toast in a ballroom, which is the only place aside from one chance encounter I once had with her that I've ever actually heard her voice. I think it's going to be fascinating and, maybe even to some degree cleansing, I don't know, to hear her talk about the program and her role in it. I think a big thing to watch is whether she kind of uses, let's call it weasel words around this and her role in it, or whether she talks frankly to the Senate and to the American people.
Whether she will or will not use the word torture will be a really interesting question.
Absolutely. And look, and she will be asked this, and they have been going through preparatory sessions for quite some time. They just had another one on Sunday. They were having one on Friday when she got the call to come over to the White House, and then she nearly pulled out. So they've anticipated. The questions are obvious what she's going to be asked. But yeah, I have to say, what I'm going to be looking for is, I don't know, obviously, exactly what she's going to say, but I think I have a pretty good sense of where she actually stands on this program as somebody who falls in that category of believing that it was productive, even if there were parts of it that were morally repugnant. She may be able to hold both of those things in her mind at the same time. I will be interested to see how defensive of it she becomes. I think if she starts to swing wildly to the other extreme and saying it was terrible, it was wrong, it was torture, that's when I start to ask myself, do you really believe that? This is not an enviable position that she is in, because she's going to have to be honest. But in a sense, it's, she can't be too honest. Like, she could really, she could blow this. I don't remember a hearing for a nominee of any senior position that was this pivotal in which this much was riding. So I'm going to be looking to basically see how much she comes clean and how honest she is about what she really thinks and the degree to which she tries to steer this conversation away from that period and towards present threats.
Shane Harris, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben. Happy to be here.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Shane for joining me on short notice. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. You need to do your part, guys. I know I say this all the time. One of these days I'm going to put it in the middle of the episode just to interrupt you, to get you to do it. You need to go rate the Lawfare Podcast and review the Lawfare Podcast and share it on all kinds of social media. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.